Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show. This is episode number 120. We have two lovely sponsors, Environments for Humans, that have two CMS-related conferences coming up that are both really cool and inexpensive and really will level you up in those CMSs. That's Craft CMS and WP, meaning WordPress. We'll tell you more about that later in the show. And Campaign Monitor, a really nice email sending service that we'll tell you all about more later in the show. That's at campaignmonitor.com. But for now, let's kick things off.
Another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about front-end web design development and more. I'm Dave Rupin. With me is Chris Coyer.
Hey, everybody. Today is a special show, but being this is our 32nd one of these, I think you all know the drill by now. It is a... No guests, no drama, no news, just questions. We got one from Mr. Don Greps, who writes in, Dear Shop Talk, how can I achieve HTML includes or imports without using any PHP or JavaScript? I know that CodeKit has the kit language that can do this, but I don't have a Mac yet. Is there any other HTML preprocessor I can use to do this? If so, can I only use the import function and still use regular HTML on it? So what Don is asking about here is, you know, the classic thing, like, let's say I have in, like, index.html, but, you know, I have lots of them. I might have a page for my about page, a page for my contact page, and I know that there's some very common elements on them. Say you have a menu or something, and that menu is going to be present on all three of those pages. You should have an include of some kind, so you're not maintaining that menu across multiple pages. That would be ridiculous. But Don sounds like he's not using any kind of back end language. This is going to be a statically generated site. So and JavaScript seems like a weird choice for that too, to like make an AJAX request for a chunk of HTML just to include on the page. I don't know why I laugh at that. I just do. What do you think about this?
So I want to say there's some dark magic back in the day where you can include, you can configure your Apache to do a server-side include, an SSI. But as you know, configuring your Apache is just about as fun as, stepping on a bunch of rakes. So I don't recommend it. And it doesn't, it's never really taken off and become a standard kind of thing that people do, so I wouldn't really recommend it.
I think there was a thing in the, now that you're saying that, there was a thing in the HTML5 boilerplate that like enabled that, didn't it, or something? I don't know.
Probably, like,
yeah. The dark magic. Nobody ever suggests that. I mean, not that I think that was a bad suggestion. I forgot all about that. There used to be some kind of fancy way to do it right through HTML, through your server, essentially. And not using a server-side language like PHP, but literally the server software.
Yeah, you use like a basically like an HTML comment, I think, to include things. So, I mean, and this is where it gets weird, right? It's like the very fact that like you, Chris Coyer, don't use it, I don't use it, no one I really know uses it, and I've kind of worked with a lot of different companies over the days, like, it's just maybe not really popular. So more or less, HTML does not have includes and imports, unless you're getting into web components. That's maybe a future option that you might be wanting to look for. I mean, you could just have like a header navigation tag that you make, and it just spits out your header navigation just like a server.
I think that you still need to define it as a template then, which you'd still be doing on every page. I'm not sure it really solves that problem.
Yeah, I mean, you're just basically working in templates, like little components, basically. Let's see here.
I would say what I thought you were going to say was something like Jekyll or something, is surely they have some kind of include system that allows for the building of templates.
Yeah, I mean, Jekyll has uses Liquid, I think, or maybe it's just, yeah, I think it's Liquid to basically you can include, you know, or it might even just be Ruby at that level, is just you're including different parts of your website. And it's a really nice templating system. I like it very much. So, I mean, if you're just building out a static site that can do that, I mean, that might be a really great option. If you're on a Mac, doesn't have a Mac. I was going to say a lot of different Mac softwares are kind of offering this, like Hammer for Mac or what is the Cactus for Mac? I think you know they're
and as
they're
you
offering.
Said, CodeKit has a language in it too. Because in there, it's no secret, you know, that like people want this. The HTML includes are a pretty common need, and you'll see this in. I think we've mentioned this before, but Jade can do it. So Jade is one of the in the canon of HTML preprocessors. That's one of the things that it offers. You can do an include. I mean, just look in the docs for how you do it. It's a pretty simple thing. I'm actually looking at them right now. I can just look at it. Includes. Yeah, you literally type the word include and then a file path. So it's pretty easy to do that way. The problem is, Don, you were specifically mentioned in your question that is, can I still use regular HTML on it? And the answer with Jade would be not really. I think there's a way that you can kind of you put some kind of character like a vertical bar or something, and then after that you can put regular HTML, but you're still putting that vertical bar there. And I can't even think if that's the actual syntax here. I'm sure I'm wrong, but it would mess with your whole world. It's not like a totally backwards compatible syntax. So, you know, that's an option, but know that, you know, that might not be the right press for you. I've tried to traverse this route with Grunt before, and there is a Grunt plugins that handle HTML includes. And actually, I think I mentioned it in a past show where I was like, you know, like in a not so great light, because I was trying to find one for it, and it kind of worked, but it was kind of complicated. And I think somebody wrote in to say that the situation there has gotten a little better. So there's a number of Grunt plugins that handle this for you, and it will work a bit like how Dave was talking about the server side things in the beginning. It's an HTML meta tag, and Grunt, mm-hmm. you know, the process runs, finds those meta tags, finds that file, and then injects that little bit in there. So that's a possibility. So, you know, look at Jekyll, look at Grunt, look at Jade, you know, even maybe Haml probably has an include because it's Ruby, and Ruby can certainly do includes. And then I know that sounds like a server side language, but you're running it locally, so you're not really depending on it in production, which is seems like the situation that you're in.
Yeah, it's. I guess moral of the story, it's really easy to do it locally. There's a lot of different options. On the server, though, you're going to need to send up compiled, you know, HTML, yeah. Or send up something, you know.
It's curious why this is so important. Like, why don't you just use a smack of PHP? No big deal.
That's what I always end up doing. It's like I get into a project and I'm like, I just need a header and a footer. Like, you know, and I just want that to be super.
That's kind
easy.
Of coming back into vogue, I think, you know, that people kind of frowned upon that stuff. And now it's starting to come back. I see articles being like, wasn't there a 37 Signals article or something that kind of, eschewing tools.
Don't
use tools, because, you know, once in a while you just need to make a website that, you know, has a picture of a pie on it and says Mom's Pie Diner and has a phone number on it, you know, like you don't need Grunt for that. You know?
Yeah, exactly. So,
all right. I think we crushed that one.
Next, Chris Lamb writes in, I'm curious if anyone out there has attempted to connect a website to a dead tree paper newsletter. picture this. Client organization has a CMS that puts all their news content in. Monthly, they need to generate a paper newsletter. They push one button and a multi-page PDF, at least as beautiful as the site, is generated with all their news content. No need to do any copy and pasting between other web between web and other apps. Obviously.
I think that covers this question pretty well. The rest of it is kind of like about human resources and stuff. The deal is they want to start on the web. and then produce a newsletter out of it. That's interesting in itself because a lot of times it goes the other way around, right? We have this paper workflow, or we have this, you know, this way to, like, create our news. Yeah, we're trying to bring it to the web.
Putting
so
our,
I think
like,
you're
mission
smart
statements.
In starting on the web.
We're putting our mission statements on some page, and it doesn't, or press releases, and it doesn't translate or something.
So it feels nice. It seems nice to me. Maybe that's just because we're web people, and it just seems like everything we do is smart and intelligent. But it seems smart to me to have this content live on the web first, and then try to figure out some way to generate it a PDF out of it. Surely there's a way. I mean, in a previous show, somebody asked about, is there a way to make a PDF through JavaScript? And you know, it looks like there's a pretty good library to do that. Certainly, you could just print to PDF, because this doesn't sound like something that needs to happen over and over. Like, one person could do it probably. So you could have a template that's part of your CMS that defines what this print layout will look like. And I know this is weird and rare, and not a lot of people do this, but you could, you know, just have a totally a different layout that just works for print a little bit better, and then print, save as PDF, and there you go, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Just a really good print style sheet. I have a friend, this is not a plug, there, it's a company in town, XOXCO, but they have this thing called Packager that does kind of a little bit of this functionality.
Oh, really?
It's basically like you basically leverage all your content management system, and then you can like basically build up your newsletter or what, you know, any other materials that you're looking. You could build an ebook from all the your blog posts or something, or your emails, you know. And they even like have it to where you can like publish an iOS newsstand app. So it's basically like an app that exists in newsstand and stuff like that. So, I mean, there are companies out there who are trying to kind of solve this, but this is, it, I mean, they charge money for this, so it's don't expect it to be free. So, cause it's kind of, they have a pretty sweet UI in terms of how they let you assemble things. So anyway,
that's neat. The reason it feels smart is that you that way now you're starting to perhaps, you know, and I'm not like a super content strategy master, that your content can just live in one place, you know, in not just like a pile of content, but you have this like chunk of content that represents a news article and the metadata associated with it and custom fields associated with whatever. And one of the places that content can go is the web, and you write a template that sucks in that data and uses how I'll use it. Maybe someday you'll want to have several different websites that have different reasons, or you'll want to syndicate it through RSS, or you want to have a mobile specific site for that. And now in your case, you're just adding one more place where that content can go, and that's print. And I think that that's possible, and you've already like maybe made one of the harder jumps, and that you're kind of storing the content in a place that's for storing content.
Mm-hmm. I always, whenever this comes up, I think the idea that you can recycle your content into something like you could sell is pretty awesome. My biggest example is, do you know that podcast, This American Life? Are you familiar, Chris?
They put it
out. Yeah. Okay. They put it out every week or so, and it's like this hour long epic podcast or whatever. And then they'll do these like compilation CDs that are kind of like the best of stories, and they'll charge $20, $40 for these CDs. And it's like, I buy them every time or whatever. Cause I'm like, I just want to hear those stories I got for free already. I just want to hear them again. And maybe I can put them in my car as well. So, like that's my quintessential example of like being able to like resell things or repackage things. Like,
yeah, it was probably very easy for them to do because they, I don't know. It's a good example. I can't speak to what their CMS is like, but certainly they have some kind of system that makes this possible and easy for them to do.
Yeah. Some kind of like tagging content chunking kind of system or whatever. So anyway, it's so
you know where there's another
helps.
Place that content can go? Another place that content can go is email. And so if that CMS spits out an RSS feed, you could send that RSS feed over to a service like Campaign Monitor. And I feel like I need to do like a Audible HR tag here. This, we are doing a sponsor spot now for Campaign Monitor. That's campaignmonitor.com. But I'm also not kidding in that good content can easily be reformatted and been pushed over to a service for sending out email. So let me just tell you about Campaign Monitor a little bit. They're an email sending service, and there's so many things that if you've never sent a newsletter before are things that you might not think about that are difficult. For example, let's say you have 10,000 people on an email newsletter list. How do you send that out? Do you send it, you know, through your Gmail account? No, that would be a problem because they literally just won't let you do that. Do you like come up, send it through your, you know, your SMTP server on your own server? You could, but that looks a little shady, and there's chances that you are seen as a spammer, and that can be a problem with that. It's so much better to like offload this stuff to a service that handles it for you, because then they do all the right smart stuff that makes sure that the email newsletters that you send not only look good across all these different devices and stuff, but actually aren't spammed and stuff. They're sending them all the smart ways, and they send fast and they send reliably and all that stuff. That's why I think the email sending is like the ultimate reason to use a web app. Like, if there's anything I will shell out money for in this world, it's help me send my emails better. So if you've never used anything like this before, imagine, you know, you have your grandma's pie shop or whatever, and she wants to send a newsletter. It can help with every aspect of that. I know I'm just dwelling on this, but I kind of enjoy talking about this. There's like you could get a form, be like, okay, well, we need a list of all the people that we're going to send it to. Maybe she's got 50 of them collected already, but you want to collect more through the website. Well, they'll give you a little form you can embed on your website. That way, when people visit the website, they type their email address in, and now they're signed up for this newsletter. And it's like, well, now we need to design the newsletter to send. Well, they have templates you can pick from, go through that process, create the email right within their interface, right on the web, and then send out to that list. Or maybe you have a blog on the site, and the blog just, you know, when you type a blog post, you just want that to go out to the list too. They can help with that. It's just it just covers everything that has to do with sending email from the, like, I want to help anybody do this from the, you know, I have no experience to some deep, nerdy, like, API level stuff. So Campaign Monitor does it all and more. Thanks for your support for Shop Talk Show. Let's do another question.
Another question. Tim Teeling writes in, what's the best way to compress vector graphic from a vector graphic from Illustrator to the web? There used to be an SVG option saved for web and devices, but it's gone in CS6. What SVG specs are best to use?
Good question. I didn't know that everybody, I think a lot of us are familiar with save for web and devices. Sometimes they call it the claw in Photoshop stuff, because it's shift option control or shift option meta key, whatever that is on your operating system, and then S, you know, and it brings up that special dialogue that allows you to, in the case of Photoshop anyway, pick JPEG, PNG, or GIF and adjust the quality settings and stuff, because it's specifically for, like, oh, I see, you're going to use this on the web. Let's give you controls for that. I didn't realize that Illustrator had SVG as an option in Illustrator when you did that. I hardly ever use that, because you don't have to use that. You can just save as SVG from Illustrator. Mm-hmm. And once you've picked SVG, you can save it and you pick the file name, and then you get this additional dialog box in Illustrator that has a bunch of extra SVG options. And I think that's kind of a confusing moment for some people. Like, what are those? What are the best things there? It lets you, like, the very first thing at the top of it is SVG profiles. And you open that, and there's a bunch of, like, indecipherable things that you can pick in there.
Which is awesome, because it's like, of course I know the profile I'm trying to use.
Yeah, so the profile you want to use, I'm pretty sure, is just SVG 1.1. There is an option in there that's a particularly important one that says preserve Illustrator editing capabilities. If you leave that on, you're going to get some crazy stuff in there. I would generally turn that off. And so now that you've turned that off, you might want to save a .ai and then also save a .svg just to like super ensure that whatever you've built and worked with is just it does retain its Illustrator editing capabilities. Generally, it does okay anyway with the SVG, but you know it certainly won't be a small web ready file. It does some crazy stuff. I mean, if you want to try it out, just take one file, save it both ways, and look at the difference, and it's pretty dramatic. So Tim is asking, what are the best settings? Well, make sure that's off. Pick SVG 1.1, and then don't really worry about it too much, I don't think. The point being that if it's a tiny little file, you're probably doing something, I don't know, it's probably okay the way it is, or you can run it through some kind of, like you're using it as part of an icon system or something, and then the build process that does that is going to clean it up anyway. There is a build tool called SVGO, that's a command line tool for optimizing SVG. You would be very smart to run it through something like that. That's going to clean up lots of the junk in there and stuff. So if definitely if you're going to use SVGO, then just, you know, just save it with those basic settings from Illustrator and run it through that, and you'd be good to go. I don't think you're going to – there's no perfect settings that come right out of Illustrator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're all wrong, I think,
right,
from Illustrator.
They're not optimal.
But I was going to say Todd Parker from Filament Group had this talk at ArtifactConf. We talked about it before, Environments for Humans. But Leaving Pixels Behind was the name of the talk. And if you find his deck, if you Google it or whatever, slide 93 has like his setup. Like he does SVG 1.1, like the SVG type or whatever, the only style elements or include style elements or whatever, one decimal place, uncheck responsive, and ironically responsive is not the option you want, fewer T-span elements, and then Unicode and stuff. And he kind of has this whole thing. There's other ways you can make SVGs smaller. It is like by like manually adjusting things, you know, like combining paths and stuff like that when you can. Basically, just always remember every time you have a point in your vector, that is a separate point. And if it's on that point is on a different layer, that's two points or whatever. So anyway, that's, yeah. Then the optimizers are really pretty awesome. They'll crunch it down.
We'll
and then,
put a few links into the show notes, I think, here, because you're right. Yeah. There's actually some good blog posts out here that tell you what things to click and unclick. And I think that's what Tim is really asking. I know we're trying to level up this answer a little bit and say, which is important too. And Dave's right on every single one of those things, you know. But yeah, the point is, do the best you can out of Illustrator, and then you're going to have to learn some stuff here, because you're never going to get anything perfect out of Illustrator. There's going to be some additional things you need to poke around with SVG to figure it out.
Yeah,
your own golf, as they say.
And he said CS6. I think it's back in Creative Cloud, or maybe it's not save for web, but it's save as SVG. I think it's save as.
I just upgraded to Creative Cloud. Are you on Creative Cloud?
I'm on Creative Cloud, so I may be no help to you on the SVG side of things. So I apologize, but I think you save as and not save for web. So that's the thing. So,
oh,
all right,
for sure.
Boom. Tim Evco writes in, I'm starting to hear the phrase tech bubble a lot, and it's very disheartening. Do you guys believe we're in a tech bubble? If so, is it we, the web designers, developers, who have to worry, or is it more threatening to investors, entrepreneurs, and 30-year-old billionaires?
I feel a little unqualified to answer about the economy of tech altogether.
Yeah, I would go ahead and say I already thought the bubble would have bursted by this point. But
point of a bubble is that the bubble bursts, right? And then when that happens, it's really a bummer, right? Because then it becomes a lot. There's less like trust in, it's harder to get VC for ideas in the future, because everybody's like, oh, tech, that's over. Why would I give you any money?
Right.
And is that such a big problem anyway? I mean, over on the CodePen podcast, we just did an episode talking about our experiences with VC. And I don't know. Of course, we're just one app and we're just three guys working on one thing. But I don't. We certainly don't need it. I don't know. I guess I just don't really care. If it becomes hard for people to raise $20 million again for their little idea, like, does that? Do I care?
Is that a problem? Like, yeah. I mean, it is going to be hard. Like, so if there's a bubble or whatever that bursts, like, entrepreneurs, investors, 30-year-old billionaires, those are the people who lose their money. I heard about, who is it, Vince McMahon, the like WWE guy. He like lost $250 million of his net worth in one day, like a third of his net worth or something in one day. So that's like a big deal. Like, I mean, if those guys lose money, then startups lose money, and then and businesses and investments lose money, and that ultimately will trickle down to you losing your job or possibly being on the chopping
and
block.
That's, so yeah.
It does affect
So I do care about that stuff. I didn't mean to be totally heartless about
this. No, no. And it might affect something like autonomous, like CodePen. Like maybe now all these developers don't have $30, you know, or what do you charge, $70 a year for a thing? Or
yeah, it's 75 for basic plans. 75. There's now a bunch of plans now, though, so it's
okay. So 70, maybe they won't have that $75 a year, but maybe it'll actually be a boom for you because now these people are unemployed and they need to get a portfolio out, and you know, so maybe it's actually a bubble would work really
you're
well.
You're 100% right about that. We thought, I don't know. There was some kind of woofoo went up and down, around woofoo. There was recession and not recession and stuff like that. And it seemed to never affect woofoo or, in fact, help because woofoo did, you know, if for those of you don't know, I know we've probably talked about it a bunch of times. It's still out there. It's a web app that helps people build web forms, but it can take this job that could have been very expensive internally or this very hard, difficult thing and made it cheap and easy. So sometimes a bust like that kind of helps a company because, you know, it's like, well, we can't afford custom development anymore. I guess we'll just have to use this little old tool.
Right. I mean, companies before Wufoo, you know, were paying some dude tens of thousands of dollars a year to build web forms when it could take, you know, somebody else, you know, just an employee they already have, like a few minutes on and $100 a month or something, I don't know, with Wufoo and like they're getting their web forms out. So, I mean, yeah, it depends on the startup, I guess is sort of what we're saying, huh? It's kind of like,
certainly we all wish for a tech industry that is stable and happy and, you know, money moves around okay and people respect it and the jobs are solid and stuff like that. So I don't know. I mean, the feel of it for me seems fine, but I'm just, you know, some dude sitting in my attic in Wisconsin. So what do I know?
I think it's fine too. It is interesting. What's interesting to me is more so like the competition that's happening right now. Like we just heard recently about OSX Yosemite or whatever, and it like has like it basically like tries to replace Dropbox and WhatsApp and all these other, you know, like it's the classic like Apple kills disruption. This app, you know, kind of Gizmodo post, but like I mean that's where it gets a little weird to me is like whole businesses can be replaced by companies just implementing a feature. That's really weird to me. But also, don't work at a blog for dogs startup. Those are probably the first to go. That's my
God, I tweeted something the other day that was kind of, it was just like, you know, like so deep thoughts by Chris, ugh, you know, but it was about how websites kind of like are like the websites of the future are just going to do the same stuff they do now. You know, that's what a good website does is it just solves some kind of basic human need and it's not an original thought and it's not even particularly interesting. But that was my overall point was that like if you're working at blogging for dogs kind of thing, it doesn't solve any particular actual need of human beings. So it's not going to do well, no matter how the you know, or maybe it will do well in a really thick bubble, you know, that there's money throwing around everywhere. But companies that like do a good job at solving things for actual people will always be useful.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
All right.
Okay. Let's do. We have Environments for Humans, our long time fantastic sponsors here at Chop Talk Show, having some summits coming up, and they're coming up super quick. So there are two of them, and they're based on CMSs, and they're taking kind of a new approach to their CMS summits. For one, they dropped the price on them so that they're just trying to get as many people in here as possible, because they're one-day bangers, like, let's level up our ability in these CMS things. So June 17th, which is probably like next week when you're listening to this, is the Craft CMS one. And you remember it's a little bit like one of the developers for Expression Engine, who made a lot of the plugins for it, went off and created his own CMS. And it has a lot of strong buy-in. People are pretty excited about Craft CMS. It's a full-day conference on June 17th about Craft. So people just talking about Craft. And there's people from HappyCog there that, you know... and Pixel and Tonic, people from agencies that are using and are excited about this CMS, and then people from Craft CMS, you know, the actual company that produces it. So it's $99. That's all this thing costs to go and, like, spend the day leveling up your ability in the CMS. If you want to get excited about it too, you can do that. And then the next day, June 18th, is the WP Summit. So the WordPress one. And you know how often we talk about WordPress here on Chop Talk Show. Mm-hmm. Just a fantastic CMS. I think about it daily how much I like WordPress. So nothing against Craft or anything else, but it is just a darn good CMS.
I hello worlded Craft the other day, and it's really delightful once you like get over the learning curve. It's really awesome, and this would be the perfect conference, right, to get you kind of up to speed on what's going on in Craft. And then, but I mean, yeah, like WordPress too, it's like the internet's workhorse, right? It's the if I'm trying to make it a car, I don't know, it's like the Ford Focus or something on the web. It just runs forever and it works. Or maybe Honda Accord would be a better one. But
yeah, maybe, but maybe it would be something, like, maybe it is the Honda Accord, because it's not like it's just like we do this things the same way we always have, you know, like maybe that's like Porsche or something, where, you know, the design of it barely ever changes, but like it does change. Like they stay up to times, they stay up with security, they stay up with updating the back end of it. They innovate new features on it. It's like, it's not only just like, I don't mean to be like disagreeable or anything, but I feel like they're more than just the classic old CMS. They still do good stuff.
No, I mean, there's a lot of good things. It's pretty great. All right.
Anyway, level up. Go to environmentsforhumans.com to see both of them, or literally go to CMS Summit or WPSummit.com and do the thing. You know what? There's a code too. I'm gonna dig it up. But you read the next question while I.
Yeah,
do
I was
that.
Gonna say it's a price you can't beat, so we gotta get that discount in too. So, are you digging?
I know
that the next one's an audio question.
Well, the coupon code is for sure going to be Shop Talk Toe. So just put it in and save money on it. Whatever the discount is, I forget what it is, but it's only $99, so it might be like a $10 or $20 discount. God, I'm such a jerkhead for not knowing, but seriously, use the coupon code Shop Talk Show.
Andy Mick Redson.
Hey guys, I'm about to go start working at a full-time job where the team of developers there uses Git. I use Git a little bit for myself, but mainly just GitHub as a repository. And haven't really done any branching or creating forks in my projects or any of the stuff that really gets made to be used for. So I'm a little nervous about going and working with this team and looking like a fool. So is there any kind of etiquette or anything to worry about as far as what you commit to the project, when you branch it, when you fork it? Or is all that kind of stuff going to kind of come from the team? I just don't want to get in there and look like a fool, look like a complete rookie in front of everybody. Just looking for any kind of help. Thanks a lot.
Nice. Working with other people.
Very good question. And you know, I like to try to get at the root of questions. And I think, Andy, because you already care about etiquette, because you're already thinking about it and trying to learn about it, you're going to do just fine. You know,
it's
the people that are jerks are the people that have problems. But it's good to learn about. I wish I kind of knew more. Certainly there is, because Git is such an open, there's lots of ways you can work with it, especially with GitHub. For example, perhaps this team that you go work on just does every everything through pull requests. That's a possible way to work. That's kind of how it worked internally at SurveyMonkey. Everything was a pull request. So if you work on some stuff, you work on it in your kind of branch, and then you're like, okay, I have this file. I'm going to submit a pull request to this other branch and kind of explain myself, and people can look over the code and vet it before that it's accepted. But at CodePen, we haven't quite moved to that yet. You know, maybe it's just because there's a few enough people here that it's not a big deal. We use branches extremely heavily. You know, just like if you're working on any old little thing, just snap a branch, because it's such a low impact thing. It's not like it like doubles the amount of files that it saves on the thing or something. There's some internal cool way that Git operates that a branch is like just barely does anything. I'll just work on a branch, then I'll just merge it over. You know, even the branches might even be multiple layers deep. You know, I might have a development branch, but then do something development-y on that development branch and then merge that in. You know what I mean? So we're just like branch heavy, but not pull request heavy. Whereas, have you done the heavy pull request thing? I think you
That, right? I mean, so we're a 3-person team for the most part when we develop and stuff. And so we usually just hand stuff over, you know, on master, unless you're going to do something really radical, you know, like I'm refactoring all the CSS. You know, that's like, but I don't think that's a great thing for larger teams at all. Like, I don't recommend. I think working in your branch, your feature, your pull request, that's the best way. I mean, that it's just like, then it's like you can't break the master build, you know, there, or there's a merge process to get it into master. It's not just,
there's some chance that everybody works on master at this place, but I think that's probably etiquette wise, that's probably the first thing to go.
If you're like, I mean, if you think about a tree, like a physical tree or whatever in your backyard, like if you lose a branch, big deal. Like it broke off. It was terrible. You know, it was rotten. That's not a big deal. But if your whole master tree trunk falls over, that's actually super terrible for your tree. I would always work in a branch when
I'm sure you could roll in on day one and just be like, hey, how do you guys do Git stuff here? You know, and I'm sure they'd be happy to explain to you how they operate. In fact, the nerdier amongst them is very excited to have that conversation with you.
Well, and it's really easy. Like, I mean, you just say Git branch my branch, right? And then you say Git checkout my branch, and then you're in your other branch, and then you just work like you're working like normal.
Mm-hmm. Etiquette-wise, though, everybody will see that branch, so maybe they have little internally etiquette stuff that's like, hey, make sure you clean up your junk branches too.
Right. Also, like rebase that. Or I've seen places do that, like so that you're only putting one feature commit.
See, I'm
into
very
master,
very interesting so. To that too. I got into rebasing for a while, but then there's like, there's some risk in rebasing, so I think etiquette-wise, that's interesting too. Is that it kind of like smashes everything into one commit, and sometimes that's nice because sometimes you do a pull, but you forgot to commit your own stuff, and then you like do commit it and then pull, and then it has to do this merge, and then the merge becomes a commit all to itself that's kind of useless in the Git history. So if you rebase it, you can kind of get rid of that. And then it's like, but then where do you back up if something goes wrong? Because now I don't understand it all the way. And it's a part of etiquette. It's not just like, how do I use Git? There's how do you use Git and what is like allowed at this particular institution? Like, would they slap your wrist if you cherry picked from another branch? Is that like uncool at this job? Or, you know what I mean? Stuff like
right.
that.
Right. Yeah. Like if you're on branch A and you pull a little bit from branch F, like the features in branch F, like, is that taboo?
That's like, true too. Cause you might actually, because your branch might be like on track to hit master sooner than that one is. And you're like, ooh, you crossed the streams there a little bit. That's a good point. There's a lot. There could be a whole book on Git etiquette probably.
I think the big thing is just ask when you're confused. Absolutely, just stop ship and ask when you're confused.
That's why DevOps is such an interesting job, isn't it? Hopefully there's a person that is ready to answer that question, and in fact, that's their job is to answer that question.
Yeah, their whole deal is how do I deploy successfully, and so mm-hmm. Anyway, and there might even be code reviews involved. We haven't even talked about that. You know, like when you finish a branch, you have to sit down with people and they just make fun of your branch for an hour.
Right. And I think that's the advantage of the pull request thing is that it's not clear when you merge it. Like, it's not clear just like going over and looking at a branch, like what's unique to that branch, because it just contains the entire Git history, the entire project. Whereas a pull request is like, has everything. It's like a chunk of code that's like ready for review.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, and hopefully it's a really isolated change. It's like you just worked on one thing. You didn't try to like touch every file in the database or the Git repo. So
I mean, even if you did, I think it could still be a pull request. But
totally, yeah. All right.
Okay. Hopefully. George Bach writes in, I am a developer at a mid-sized software as a service company, and we have a pretty successful product. Our product has an API, and there's several other companies that sell website integrations and third-party plugins to our customers. So we'll have to set the stage for that, I think, a little bit to make that more clear. Our company even receives fees to recommend certain preferred partners. Let's stop there for a second. So this George works at some company, and let's just like use WooFoo because we just always use them. Neither of us work there anymore or whatever. Right. They had an API. And so now there's other companies that make something to sell to WooFoo customers would be the ideal, right?
So So I have a site that maybe white labels WooFoo or something, or uses
the WooFoo API to like suck down form data and do some cool analysis of it or something.
Yeah, exactly.
So then, okay, so that would be a preferred partner. And then as WooFoo, we might say, hey, go check out this other company. They do something really cool with our data. Like if you're a customer of ours, you might love what they do. And we might, and then there might be some fees in there to do that. Like that company that does that might be like, "Hey, WooFoo, we'll throw you a few bucks, hey, if you send customers our way." That's what George would be talking about, preferred partners. And this is totally hypothetical. I don't even think this is the case for WooFoo, but it could be, you know, because it has an API. So then George goes on to say, do you think it would be unethical or a conflict of interest for me to develop my own premium WordPress plugin and sell it on my own time? We have one particular preferred partner who already sells a premium WordPress plugin. So whatever API that the company that George works at offers would somehow make sense to get worked into a WordPress plugin. And George didn't say where he works here, so this is all kind of hypothetical. But George wants to become one of those preferred partners.
Yeah, basically he wants to use his insider knowledge to become a competitor to a preferred partner that already exists.
Now you're right. And now that you said it that way, is at first I was like, I don't know. No, I don't inherently think that building a product that works with another product is a moral conflict. It might be a moral conflict the way that you put it, where you're trying to push out somebody who's already running a business. You know, it's a little bit like you just said with Apple, right? Like I use a thing called Picture Life or something because I'm sick of having an iPhoto library that's too big to fit on my laptop. So I use it to keep all my pictures in the cloud. But I don't think of it like Flickr, where I only put pictures that I kind of want other people to look at. I'll put like one copy on Flickr to 50 I would put in Picture Life anyway. So I pay Picture Life, and now Apple comes along and says, "Oh, hey, we have that now too, and it's cheaper, and it's just built into iPhoto." They're going to as part of iOS. So they're just pushing out companies that, you know. But this is even worse than that, in that it's like this preferred partner, I don't know, they built their thing on your system, you know. And you're like, hey, that's a good idea. I'm going to take it. Bye.
Well, and if they're doing it terribly, that's one thing. I mean, WordPress plugins are open source. They are, this is where it gets like, I'm not a lawyer. So like whatever you do, if you like talk to a lawyer, if you take any of our advice, please. But I mean, WordPress is all GPL, which means like you can take anything anyone does, copy it and do your own thing and even sell that thing to my knowledge. Right. I mean,
yes,
it's not cool. It's not ethical, but it's maybe not illegal. I guess.
You're right. You're saying so Woo Themes, they're a big popular shop, right, that sells themes for WordPress. Because they're trying to be buddies with WordPress, and they are buddies with WordPress, those themes that they sell have to be GPL. So if you were like the Captain Dick, you could just download them all, set up your own, you know, store using WooCommerce if you wanted to, and just resell their themes. It would be like the world's least cool thing to do that's also not illegal.
Right. To my knowledge. Again, not a lawyer.
No, but...
If you go to jail, tough luck.
And I think maybe it's a little bit more complicated than that because the code is GPL, right? But I think it's somehow cool to like...
But the product is MIT.
Right, or in the product being things like visual design assets and stuff that are part of those themes. Mm-hmm. Like, they, you know, they probably can actually stop you somehow. Not to mention social pressure, you know?
But is the IP... The IP, like if... Connecting to a company's API is not like a stamped, sealed, you know, sign. That's not a thing they can prevent, you know? I mean, no. To my knowledge,
I would
right?
think if it's different enough and you're just doing the same thing they're doing, it doesn't feel particularly shady to me unless it's just a land grab on your part. Just like, I don't know, I think I can do a better job and I'm the one who works here, so... Goodbye, somebody else who had this idea.
But if their stuff is just total abandonware and it's subpar user experience, I mean, that's competition. That's capitalism.
Yeah, you're
at the same point. You know,
I'm
on both sides of the fence here.
You work at the dang product. You know, to leverage that to your own advantage is just reality.
It would seem that your company would also be invested. That's where maybe another ethical issue is: does your company want you using your internal expertise to build public-facing things or whatever?
And I can see it both ways, which is why you should definitely bring it up that that's your intention to do, definitely. Yeah.
And it could be like your project manager or your manager is just like, I don't care, man. Do whatever you want. Like, that would be cool if we had a good one.
Yeah, they might like it. They might be like, this is going to help you, and it's going to help us, and please do it. Absolutely.
Yeah, we can't give you a raise, but we can, you know, make you a preferred partner.
Or they could say, you know what, we're worried about you, George. We worry that your time will be spent working on this and not working on our thing, and that doesn't feel right, and we're going to say no on this one, but... You know,
or this client, our preferred partner, makes us millions of dollars. And if you try to usurp them, we all go out of business. I mean, that's another thing.
Right. Too. Maybe you don't know the whole story, even though you might think you do or something. I don't know. So that's plenty of food for thought, I think.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I would say, what's your gut? Just go for it?
No, my gut is ask. Talk about
ask.
It. Say, this is my intention is that I want to do this. So be very clear, because it sounds like you do. I want to do this. What do you think about that company that I currently work for? And if you think it's a good idea, not only say I want to do that, but lay out why you think it's a good idea that you can. But like you're asking us, be like, I understand that there may be some moral considerations here. And how do you think about it?
That's good. That's good. I would say, talk it over. Just say, I have thought this through and I think I could do a better job, you know, and then people will voice misgivings, but I don't think I kind of err on the side of just go for it. But, yeah, I don't know, but don't lose your job over a WordPress plugin.
Unless you make a lot of money.
Yeah. All right. Good luck out there. All right. Javier Cubides writes in, sorry, Javier, I'm currently working on a project and design calls for use of full screen image backgrounds. In order to optimize this for mobile devices, I'm using media queries. It works like a charm. However, something bothers me. If I resize a window and there's a small brink of time where the web page has no background when the image gets loaded. So there's like, if you start small or something, you get
We mentioned this on a podcast recently. Somebody wanted to do a full page carousel, and they were also concerned about how do you have the images be the right size and stuff like that. We're like, well, if there were CSS background images, you could just use media queries to, test the screen size or whatever and pixel density and stuff, and then just use the appropriate size thing. And that's what Javier is already doing here. But yeah, but you, as you were about to say, I think like there is this moment where a media query, one of them becomes, false and one of them becomes true essentially. And it says, oh, I see, you want to change the URL. You want to change the resource being used. And it then needs to make that request for the new one. And there might be a bit of a flash of white. Right.
I got some advice here. Okay. Ready? Yep. Use progressive JPEGs. Then you'll never have the white. It'll take the first scan and something will load quickly or at least quicker than you're currently getting. So progressive JPEGs if you're using JPEG. Number two, optimize the hell out of that. Make sure it's run through Image Optim and it's as small as you can be. Mm-hmm. And add a breakpoint if you need to. And then fourth, there's a hack, and you don't want to do this, but at the bottom of your page, you can have a JavaScript thing that's like new image, and then the source is this.
And this isn't an image that you're injecting into the DOM. You're just like making a like image fragment kind of thing. You're just like having JavaScript construct an image object that has a source, and it will trigger a request for that image, but you don't actually ever have to do anything with it.
Yeah.
But then it's cached. Yeah. So then when CSS the wants memory. It later, it's already there and it can grab it.
And so that's a hack you can do. I mean, I would always side on the fact, like the kind of axiom that no one resizes the browser.
Yes, so, that's what I was going to say. So that's a hacky thing, and Dave's right, and that's clever and interesting, but it's kind of like you're just presuming that everyone is going to use every feature of your website. So, even though I'm not going to affect the page load time, I am going to impart upon them additional bandwidth weight for my page just because I feel like it, because there might not be a little flash of white for a thing. I much prefer the don't worry about it. Don't design around people that are resizing their browser window all over the place. I think most user testing teaches us that people aren't constantly whisking their browser windows around and resizing them. And if they are, they're designers, and they might actually enjoy watching that little flash of white because it shows us the underpants of a website, which we always kind of get a kick out of a little bit. And it's proof. It's proof positive. It's proof positive that you're not imparting that extra bandwidth upon a user for no reason. Mm-hmm. I would say don't worry about it. That's the answer that I would give you, Javier.
Don't worry about it and optimize. Do the proper image optimization.
Because that helps
everybody.
Progressive
JPEG and squish it down. Image Optim, that mofo. All right. But if it's a PNG, try Image Alpha. I don't know if you guys use that, but Image Alpha is next level stuff, dude. You can you can get a PNG down to like 8 kilobytes. It's pretty freaking wonderful. Cool. So
yeah, and there's always WebP and stuff too to
WebP. There you go. Play around. So anyway, there you go. Next,
Greg Perham writes in. There's a post on CSS tricks about animation tricks. One of them involves rotating a box shadow, and I was thinking, wouldn't it be interesting to make reusable? So he's working on this a little bit. So the problem is, if you want to adjust a little bit of a box shadow, there's all these sub-property, there's box shadow is the property, and then the value for box shadow, if you can imagine this, CSS people, is something like, 5px, 8px, black, or something. So there's four, sub-values of it. And, let's say you want to change the box shadow's color from black to red, you can't just say box shadow color, right? You have to go 5px, 5px, 7px, red. So Greg is asking why.
This is one of my children's books. It's red shirt, blue shirt, yellow shirt, green shirt. There you go. Okay.
And
go
he's
ahead.
Like, why isn't there nth shirt?
Yeah. Darn it.
Okay. Or nth property shirt or some kind of programmatic access. And Greg is asking, rightfully so here, why isn't there a box shadow color, box shadow offset, box shadow position, stuff like that?
That's interesting.
It is a bit interesting because there often is those things, right? Like for font, there's font size and font whatever, and it has a shorthand.
It's a Yeah, it's a shorthand.
So why isn't box shadow just shorthand for subproperties? And I actually don't know the answer to that, although I can tell you in my experience of working with CSS for a long time and working with people who think about CSS and spec people and stuff, and I think of guys like Tab Atkins, they freaking always have an answer to this. This has been thought about. It's been talked about. You can probably go dig up conversations about this in the, you know, in the message boards in which they talk about this stuff. It was considered, I promise. And I can't tell you exactly why it's not allowed, but there's a reason. Terrible there's answer.
Somebody knows why. I wonder. It's weird though, right? Because there's some parser that goes through and it's like tries to parse out all the values, right?
Mm-hmm.
Based on the number of arguments that are in the
and property. We already know that some of them are optional, right? Like you don't have to do a what's the, you know, there's offset, blur, then there's blur, and inset. Then there's offset too, and you know, so yeah. You can in one of, at least some of them are not skippable and some of them are, so maybe that's part of the reason, but that's not, that's true in font too. You can like skip the line height and it still works. So that's not proof positive of why that is. I don't know. And maybe there isn't. Maybe this is one of those cases where there should have been these properties, but there isn't. I somehow doubt it. But here's a one that we can like a not an analogy, just another example of this same type of situation that comes up. Every month I hear somebody talking about this. It's transform. In transform, let's say you want to rotate something 45 degrees. So you go transform, rotate, parentheses, 45, deg, close parentheses. Then you want to add a class that translates it 50 pixels to the right. You know, I know this is a convoluted example, but stuff like this comes up all the time. So you add like dot active on it or whatever. Then you say like, you know, dot thing dot active transform translate x 45 pixels. Well, now it's not going to be rotated anymore because you've overwritten its transform property to only be translate x and not rotate anymore. So if you want to do both of those things, you want to keep it rotated, you have to repeat that rotate property in there. So like, why was transform done like this? Why isn't rotate its own property? Why isn't translate its own property instead of squishing it all into values of the transform property? And again, there's some kind of reason for it. I forget what it is exactly, but it turns out that it's just more complicated than that. That you think that these things are all separated from each other, but it's not necessarily true. And it's got occasionally gets explained to me, and then I get it, and then I forget why again, because it just seems so practical that these things would be split apart. But the reason that they're not is some kind of smart math reason, and I can't remember why. But that doesn't mean that never till the end of time should we be able to. What we're asking for here is the ability to change little parts of it in an easier way. And I think there is an answer there someday, somehow. In what form that takes, I'm not sure. But but there should be.
Yeah, that's, gosh, I'm trying to, you know, it's. It's weird. Ah, sorry. I'm like pulling up the spec, right? And it's like, it's in the backgrounds and borders spec, which have both background and border have all these features,
right?
The like simplified version, like the function, you know, and then the, like,
it's almost like we should save questions like this for when we have like spec people like on tab. And stuff.
Yeah. But, we should have like an episode where we just bring Tab in once a year and just unload on him.
Yeah, Tab's great. We have had Tab before, haven't we? Not that we couldn't get him again, but we could get, I'm sure, any number.
Should just be like our annual, hey, why?
Hey,
Bruce Lawson.
Hey, why? I play hey, why with Tab in real life whenever I see him. I'm like, okay, it's time to ask Tab some hard questions.
Hey, why?
Hey. You weren't trying to enjoy yourself, were you? I have some questions.
Yeah. Hey, did you just get a beer? Okay, hey, why?
Yeah, I know. So awful.
You're going to be here for a while? Cool. Hey, yeah. Why?
Because no secret, I don't love that either.
Are you checking your phone to like leave? Hey, why?
Yeah.
Why can't I have min margin? Oh, shoot. Okay. All right, here we go. Yes. David Beasley writes in, love the show, one of my staple podcasts. That's good. Meat and potatoes. My question is about print style sheets. I got a few questions here, actually. Are they still relevant? How do you approach them? Are there any amazing tools out there to help you identify what things to show, hide, degrade?
David, the tools thing is weirding me out a little bit. It feels like everybody's like, is there some tool to help me? And I'm not trying to single you out or whatever, but I was like, I think the tool that you should use is common sense in this case. We're talking about print style sheets. Print your site. See what sucks about it. You know, like what? Imagine yourself wanting to print that page. Why would you want to print it? What's the in what context can you imagine somebody wanting to print the website that you're looking at with your eyeballs right now? That will be obvious. I think that's not a hard question to answer. They'll be like, oh, because there's a recipe on it and they want to look at it when they cook the recipe, or there's an article on it that they're going to give to their mom and they know that their mom isn't huge on URLs, so you're just going to print it out. Or I need to bring it to a meeting and I know I shouldn't print it out, but sometimes it's just nice to have it in front of us at meetings kind of thing. I'm sure you can imagine the situation in which that printing this site is important. And then how should you design it? Well, you should make that really good, because nobody's making money selling ads on printed out pieces of paper from things, at least not that I'm aware of. Maybe some recipe sites have Butterball turkey ads on them or something that they sell in their print style sheet, but I would doubt it. So I would go like, just this is your one chance to flex your wings as a designer and just get rid of anything at all that isn't perfectly awesome on there. I don't like on CSS Tricks. I have ads on the site. It's part of my income as a human person. I need those on there, but I don't have any trepidation at all. I don't even know if I used that word correctly about removing them from my print style sheet, because it's just not, you know, I don't need to be jamming ads down people's throat on their printer.
Yeah, the only thing like where it could be cool is like if you're like, yeah, you have a recipe thing and like you print it out, you do a coupon. Yeah, or something like that. That would be cool. Or
that would
QR
be
code
cool, yeah.
Or something. I don't know.
Did it cool and you did like page break before break always. And then so it, like when you're printing it, you can like flip through the preview and see that, you know, the coupon isn't cut off onto two pages, or I could choose to print everything except the last page if I don't want to print that. You know, there's still a responsible things to do. I doubt there's a tool that's going to spit out an opinion about how you should design your print style sheet. There are, however, like base print style sheets that I've seen around. They used to be a little bit more popular, I think, but there are people like, you know what? Make your thing a serif, not a sans serif. Because serif, the whole point of serif fonts were your typefaces were to be easier to read on print, right? Whereas serif ones tend to work, or sans serif tends to work a little better online. I know that's a drastic over characterization, perhaps, but they would do things like that, you know, like make your font just a generally nice paper ready typeface, and you know, kill anything that, you know, has a class of add or a side on it, and make the width, the content area 100% wide, and you know, and then had like a section that was like, you know what you should do a lot of is display none. So here's a base selector, and then do a lot of comma separating of this selector and display none tons of stuff.
You could get really cool. Like you could kind of try to optimize your page for like a, you know, like a 45 CPL, you know, kind of min max width kind of thing or whatever. Like, I mean, you could like really work to make it like a cool printing experience if you want. My question is like, is it totally worth it? I don't know.
It might be a fun Friday afternoon thing. I always do. Every time I redesign CSS Tricks, I scrap the old one, redesign the site, and then 3 months later, I do the print style sheet just because I feel like it's kind of a fun little activity. There's all the like classic tricks that are just classic CSS tricks, not even from my website, I mean, but you know, just ones that are often shared around, like use like a pseudo, you know, do like a with href, any A that has an href on it in the after pseudo element, do content attribute href. So like links aren't just blue, but they actually show the URL there. There's That's like pretty cool. Wherever your comment section is on it, make sure you do page break before always on it, because a lot of people want to print the article, but not your dumb comments, or just hide the comments because nobody wants to print comments.
Yeah. Well, and you could even just try to make everything grayscale if you wanted. I mean, I know that's can be on the printer edge of things, but you know, I mean,
yeah,
like I always get a little pissed when I accidentally print somebody's color, like my boarding pass from Southwest. It's like, it uses every color in my printer and just like cost me $45 to print a boarding pass. So that's something to think about.
It'd be kind of neat if it would, I don't know. I was thinking of like other tricks you could do. Like instead of doing the pseudo element trick, like actually go through the links and then make a hidden div that just has all the links from the article in it. And then, you know, unhide that div when you print. So it's because I think it's obnoxious to be reading a sentence that has a big URL right in the middle of it. You know, it'd be better to just be like, hey, this thing is a link. And if you care at all, the URL is going to show when you print it, you know, but way at the bottom of the article, you know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'm just, we're just spitballing, and this is our very last question, so whatever. Any last thoughts on print style sheets? I don't have any.
Nah, I think we covered it. I suppose they are relevant. Chris gave some tips, and I don't know if there's any tools. I think you just got to do it manually. So anyhow, that's all I got, man.
Excellent!
We're done. Thanks for everyone for listening to yet another episode of the Shop Talk Show, a rapid fire episode. We really appreciate you. Thanks for listening. Thanks to all our sponsors. And we're going to be back pretty soon. We got some shows. It's going to be good. It's going to be fun.
Correct.
On our way to episode
hot summer season three.
Hot summer season, hot summer, you better believe.
We haven't even booked 1, 2, 3 yet.
I know, we gotta come up with our big idea still.
Maybe we can get like Jeff Bezos or something. Let's get some.
Yeah, let's get somebody like, yeah. That's good. We'll get there. We'll do it. Let's do it. Let's just call him.
Tim Berners-Lee. Call. I have a question.
Hey, why? Let's play Hey Why with Tim Berners-Lee on episode 1, 2, 3.
Just get shut down.
Why? All right. Thanks, everyone.
ChopTalkShow.com.